Greetings, Officer Cadillac.
Yeah, no. Hi, Graham. The Sean Bean of Formula One. It's Christian Horner. How's things at Cadillac?
Oh, Christian. Aye. Up and grand, thank you. We've chosen our drivers now. How are you since leaving Red Bull?
Yeah, no. Okay. I'm interested in running another Formula One team. So, yeah, no, how about a place for me at Cadillac?
Well, Christian, let me put it in terms that you will understand. Yeah, no.
Yeah, no. So is it yeah or no?
I mean what I say. Yeah, no, there isn't a place for you at our team, or probably any team, for a long time.
Yeah, no, I thought you might say that. Hello, welcome to Gareth Jones on Speed. I'm Garethy Zog.
Hello.
Zog, this is actually the first time we've spoken since the party after 20 years on Speed. Have you recovered?
Just about. It was a lovely weekend. I had a lovely, relaxing trip. Up to North Wales. We had a blast at the Motorsport Lounge, and getting back on Sunday was easy enough. Yeah, an easy Sunday drive of the country. That was great.
I'm interested to hear more about your drive in the Porsche Macan. I know you recorded some stuff on the journey. Can you send that to me and I'll put it in the next show maybe, yeah?
I have sent it. You should have got that right. Yeah, I recorded a few bits along the way. So, yeah, have a route through that. See what you want to make out of that.
I see it in my email now. I will dig into it.
I recorded a few thoughts about the trip. You've got some thoughts there.
But we won't talk about the Macan right now.
No, exactly.
But needless to say, in five words, you enjoyed it. It's a Porsche, it's electric, it's North Wales. What's not to like?
There you go. No, it was actually a great vehicle for the trip. It was very relaxing. Given that the weather on the way up was a bit rotten, it was nice to have a properly put together modern vehicle rather than an older car that might have a leak or two or might not manage its window defrosting quite as well. Yeah, no, it was absolutely great for the conditions and the day. Great car. Had a great drive. No range issues. All good. It was a great trip.
And I have to say, I thought you were great recording 20 Years on Speed and outstanding as a member of the Pit Stop Boys and the On Speed Band. Well done.
Well, you're too kind. I did manage to channel Chris Lowe quite successfully for a few minutes there, but hardly a patch on the On Speed Band blowing everyone away on stage. That was quite a performance.
We're quite a band, aren't we? Eh? Eh? Hey.
Yeah, no, really. I've met all the band previously, apart from your drummer.
Pete.
Pete, and I've met Chris and Steve before, obviously. Yeah, who are lovely chaps. And yeah, Chris is a terrific guitarist, really is. And yeah, absolutely, particularly on the Pink Floyd number, obviously.
Obviously.
It's kind of his speciality. But you know, he's a terrific performer. And yeah, Pete, yeah, his brother's quite something on the drums, really.
Quite something.
Very solid.
Solid is the word. You know, when we started rehearsing with the band, it was just me and Chris initially teaching him the songs, because these are songs I've written, no one else has heard before, right? And I had to play bass and sing at the same time, which isn't straightforward. But immediately Pete joined the band for rehearsals, I was able to lean on Pete and the kick drum as the bass player, and I found that my right hand playing the rhythm, if you like, Pete helped me do that, and it freed me up to sing better. Mm. There's a proper four-way communication thing going on in the band. Pete and Chris have played together. They're brothers, the Ryan brothers. They've played together for some 25 years. So they have a rapport and they're close. And I've been playing with Chris for about 12 months now. So I've got a rapport and relationship with Chris. So we've got this strong bass triangle, the three of us now, which Steve Allen can fit into any band. He's one of the greatest musicians I've ever known, and he brought a richness and quality to the sound that the band made on that night that I couldn't even hope for. Everybody did. And on behalf of Zog, Richard, myself, Sarah, and Alex, I want to say a huge thank you to those many people who made that long journey to North Wales to come and celebrate with us. It was an amazing night. All I could ever hope for, really. Thank you.
Yeah, it was great seeing everybody there. Which reminds me, Helen, I sent you a message on your Twitter account, so have a look at your messages.
Oh, right, right.
That'll mean something to somebody. Nothing particularly interesting, unless you're interested in old recorders, but...
Actually, I kind of am, really. Yeah, yeah. Well, of course I am.
I'll tell you later.
Okay, cool. Hey, should we talk about motorsport as we're here? Because we're nearly back, aren't we? We're nearly back with Formula One, but some news broke today, Tuesday, that Cadillac have finally decided on who their two drivers are going to be for the 2026 season. Now, I don't know how long their contract is. Is it more than a year? But what we do know is that Sergio Perez and Valtteri Bottas have both got race seats again. We welcome them back to the grid, don't we? Both of them.
Absolutely. And there's a little bit of a surprise in there, I think, in that, Bottas has been linked to Cadillac, for some time now.
Yeah.
And it's no surprise that they're getting a veteran driver in their lineup to lead the team, but two veteran drivers to me is a bit of a surprise. I would have expected them to go with an old guy and a young guy. Always makes a good story. You could always make a movie out of that. We'll come to that later. But they've gone for two. Real veterans. They're two of the oldest drivers you could pick to put in your cars, realistically. And that's an interesting call.
There are a lot of influences on their choice. You absolutely want an experienced F1 driver, someone who knows the procedures and how we do it in other teams. That's very, very important. And you probably want someone who's going to bring money to the team, because even if Cadillac have one of the biggest budgets available within the budget limit, you want to bring in sponsors. And Sergio Perez, apart from being a truly solid driver who just couldn't match Max, he does come with what's his name? Slim Pickens? Carlos Slim Pickens, yes. Possibly the world's wealthiest man, which is going to help that team. Graham Loudon, who I believe is the team principal, is that his title?
I think he is.
Running Cadillac at the moment. Sensible Yorkshire pair of hands, he won't be spending too much money. He'll be very careful. Experience through Manor and what was the Virgin Marussia team, of course. So he has experience in pulling a team together from scratch. So he's a good choice. I don't know.
I agree. I think he is a good choice for that. And I've only heard him talking a little bit about, plans for the team and how he sees the future with Cadillac. But I really liked what he was saying, and he sounded to me like he's going to do a terrific, very grounded, very effective job of leading the team.
Grounded.
Yeah. I think, I kind of became a little bit of a Cadillac fan in listening to him talking about things. So, I really wish them well with their debut in the sport. Yeah, it'd be great to see just how well they managed to put things together.
My mate Phil Williams, who was at Le Mans with us this year, supports Cadillac at Le Mans, and he's thrilled to bits that Cadillac are now in Formula One. And, I think an awful lot of Americans are going to feel the same way as him as well. It's going to swing the influence, the bias within the sport. There'll be an even greater American following than there was already now. And that's going to change the sport a little bit, in my view.
Well, it's a continuation, I would think, really, of a trend that's happened in the last few years, partly driven by Drive to Survive, of the greater visibility of the sport driving a bigger fan base in the States. And of course, F1 has wanted to be more of a North American sport, and it's working out for them. And of course, that's another reason for getting Sergio Perez on the team. That's going to mean they get a lot of fans in South America and North America as well. He's got a good, strong following over there. So yeah, it's going to bolster their support in the home market. I wonder, I mean, as you say, how long will those contracts be for? Will they just be signed for the first year to see how things pan out, and then they'll, you know, review things at the end of 26? I think, aren't you always a bit concerned if you're signing an older driver that you don't want that contract to be for too many years, because, you know,
they're expensive.
They're going to come to the end of their useful life.
Yeah,
which is, you know, I mean, more of a question mark over Sergio Perez than Bottas there, I think.
Okay, given that, Jacques.
But, you know, but having said that, you know, they're both still very, very quick guys.
Which one of those two would you say is the better? Oh, deep thought.
At the moment, Well, I think we're going to find out next year, aren't we?
We are, yeah.
Says he, buying more time for an answer. I'm going to say Bottas is the better driver.
Bottas has got more wins, hasn't he, than Perez. Having said that, I think Perez is very used to driving subpar cars. You know, Bottas's career was Williams, Mercedes, Steak Sauber, I'm not going to call them that, Sauber, and now Cadillac. You know, Perez had many, many years at Sauber. He had many years at Racing Point or Force India, who were average cars. So he's used to being in that sort of position. I think it's academic. I don't think it really matters. We're not looking at Cadillac winning races. We might not even be seeing Cadillac win any points in their first season as they work out the intricacies of competing in the highest echelon of Formula One with a nascent, young, fledgling team. And what you want is someone who'll get that car home regardless. You want someone who'll drive it to a very good standard. He doesn't have to be quicker than everybody else. They just have to get that car home and gather data at the moment. I wish them well and I welcome them to the grid. It's great that we've got any other team. And I like the idea of Cadillac. That appeals to me.
It will be good for the sport, for all kinds of angles, to have a North American team in there rather than, you know, a lot more of the sport has been taking place in North America, and, you know, a lot more of the culture of the fandom has been in America.
Yeah.
It makes sense that there should be an American team to balance that out a little bit. So, no, it's a good thing that's finally happening.
Not forgetting that we actually do already have an American team, Haas, although they're not really perceived to be American because they do so much of their work in Italy and the UK. Now, Cadillac will build the engines in Charlotte, I think, in the States. I think that's right. They are relying on a lot of UK and European suppliers at the moment, and they have a Silverstone base that seems to be their primary headquarters at the moment. But the name Cadillac is absolutely American, isn't it? It could not be anything else. Although it's French in origin, isn't it?
And they're going to be using a Ferrari engine, right?
Yeah, for the first couple of years.
Which, of course, is what Haas are using at the moment.
Yeah.
But I wonder if there's any sort of reason why they favoured a Ferrari engine there. Mm. If it's something to do with, I don't know, maybe just the name. It's, you know, it's such a, you know, if you want a motorsport brand name to stick on your car in any sense, you know, Ferrari is surely the best one you can pick in Formula One.
Yeah.
So Cadillac going with a Ferrari engine on their entry into Formula One makes a lot of sense from that point of view.
Cadillac stands for luxury and performance, you might argue. So to be associated with the Prima performance brand Prima, I did like that, makes an awful lot of sense. We wish them well, we wish them well. But hey, let's talk about another Formula One thing. I've only caught up with this in the last 48 hours. I have to admit, it took me two sittings to see this. I'm talking about F1, the movie.
Ah, okay, you finally caught up.
You saw it in the cinema, I saw it at home. I wish I'd seen it in the cinema, I bet it looked gorgeous in the cinema.
It did, yeah. Well, I saw it on an IMAX screen, in fact.
Ah!
If something has been shot for IMAX,
yep.
I like to see it on an IMAX screen if I can. And yeah, it looks fantastic, sounds fantastic. It's, very good direction, photography, sound design, which, yeah, you wouldn't get the full effect of, you know, on a home screen, but it's still a good-looking movie, you know, on any format, I think.
There was one sequence in the film, a pit stop, that they shot beautifully. It was going and out, you know, it was, you know, we see Formula One in real time on television, and that 1.8 seconds or 1.9 seconds that Red Bull can do a pit stop in, you're hyper concentrating, but of course the movie has the luxury of pre-editing those shots and getting the perfect angle for those shots, and it really did make F1 look truly magnificent. That's what I liked about the film. There was stuff I didn't like about the film. What was your reaction? Did you love it? Did you have provisos? Did you go in with an open mind? You kind of have to suspend disbelief. My first thought is, okay, I'm not watching a documentary about Formula One, and we'll start from there.
Yeah, 100%. I really enjoyed it. I had some issues with, well, I had issues with a couple of things, but my main takeaway was it's a tremendously entertaining, great-looking, roller coaster of an F1 fairy story.
Yeah.
Like I say, it's not a documentary. It's not a gritty drama.
Yeah.
It's a fairy story. And so a fair number of liberties are taken with, you know, how quickly a team might be able to develop this thing or that. Or,
yes.
You know, come up with some technical innovation and then put it into effect. And how quickly a, you know, mid or backfield team can make progress either in the course of a race or a season.
Yeah, or a stint.
Spoiler alert, you know, one driver seems to have, his only effective tactic seems to be to cause a crash during a race in order to make sure his team wins. Then again, you know, okay, that has happened
that did
before,
happen.
So maybe it's not so. But, you know, those kind of, and then the commentators during the race giving you an extraordinary amount of detail on just how this driver who is currently in 15th place is going to be able to make up ground if this happens and that happens.
Yeah.
And why? No, I can go with all of that for the sake of telling a good story. And they do tell a good story. And they've got a great cast to help that story unfold. Brad Pitt is, you know, fantastically charismatic as the veteran driver. Damson Idris as the young up-and-coming hotshot is terrific, and it's great seeing the actress from Ted Lasso, Sarah Niles, as his mother. She's great, and Javier Bardem. No, everyone works really well. Say that they tell a really good story. It's well paced. The little, you know, subplots here and there are well used.
What I did like about the film, Zog, was the drama, the sort of things that happen to the team over the course of the season are very much the sort of things that really, really do happen in Formula One. You know, there is some kind of scurrilous behaviour by someone reporting what's going on in the team. There are technical infringements. There is bad luck where you think someone's going to win and, oh no, they don't quite get it right. There's a red flag, three laps sprint. No spoilers, I'm not going to say how it plays out. And concerns over team ownership, that the board are pulling one way and the people who run the team and the drivers are kind of pulling another way. These are very, very much the stories of Formula One that we've witnessed happen to real teams on numerous occasions over the years.
Yeah.
But I couldn't help overall feeling that for all their choice of the drama, the real world drama stories of Formula One were kind of even more shocking and more amazing. I'm thinking of Braun's incredible season in 2008. That really shouldn't have happened. The Abu Dhabi, debacle with Lewis Hamilton and, you know, those last few laps. More extraordinary things have actually happened in Formula One than happened in that film. And the two other motorsport movies that I would compare, three other motorsport movies I would compare to the F1 movie is, of course, Grand Prix, which is, what, 67, 68, was that made?
Something like that, yeah, John Frankenheimer.
Which was kind of gritty and moody and tonal, wasn't it? Lovely.
Yep.
A book, it's not a movie, it's a book I read, which I believe was called Grand Prix. When did I read it? Very early 80s. And it's set against motorsport in the 1970s. Have you read this book, seeing the expression on your face? You look like you might recognise it.
I haven't. No. I was just going to raise an objection that you can't compare a book to a movie. So I think we have to
okay.
rule this one out.
Okay, yeah, all right, fair enough.
Because you, I'm sure you can think of two more movies.
Yeah. The book Grand Prix was amazing because it actually rotated around another backstory, something else that was going on, that someone was using the team as a way of laundering money from diamond thefts, if I remember correctly. Ooh. And that gave it another level. And I was kind of hoping that the F1 movie might have something like that going on as well. But no, it was purely about the sport and the business of Formula One and the personality. So fair play. And then the other one is the best one of them all, in my opinion, which is not... what was the Tom Cruise movie called? Days of Thunder.
Days of Thunder. But that's NASCAR.
It's motorsport movies I'm talking about, rather than F1 movies. Driven, the Stallone movie, which was the worst film ever made. I loved it. It was so terrible. You've seen it? Oh, it's awful.
I have. I was going to get into the worst movie ever made. I mean, I agree it is not a good film, but I could think of quite... Yeah, there are worse movies.
Car movies.
Stallone has been in worse movies.
Yeah. But my favourite of all the motorsport movies is Talladega Nights, the Ballad of Ricky Bobby.
Yeah.
Which, as far as I'm concerned, is perfection in terms of motorsport.
A fine documentary.
So I think we'll leave it there.
Rush, I think, is what is.
Oh, of course.
That's a very fine racing movie.
Yeah, because it's real.
Movie, Grand Prix. You know, if you haven't seen it and you like your motor racing, you like your Formula One, that's a very interesting film to watch. It's a little long, if we're being critical, but apart from that, it is a decent movie with good racing. There are a lot of cameos by drivers of the time, which brings me to my main criticism of this recent F1 movie, which is that they missed the chance, in my view, to ground it better in the contemporary sport. Just to kind of briefly go over this, so a handful of the team principals make an appearance.
Yes.
Zak Brown and Fred Vasseur have one line each and barely manage to play themselves convincingly.
Yes.
Toto Wolff has a moment in the pit lane, which again is, you know, he's just a bit, you know, wooden and...
He was okay, I thought.
Not very good. He was okay.
Yeah.
On the other hand, Günther Steiner, fabulous. Understood the assignment.
Yeah.
Delivered 100%. A magnificent, very brief performance, but he was perfect. But the thing is, here's the thing. You had all these drivers, you know, in the background of some shots, and they were clearly definitely at races. You know, they had shot at races.
Incredible
with
the way they
other
did
drivers
it.
There.
Yeah.
But they didn't have a single moment, apart from a fist bump with Alonso, they didn't have a single moment where the fictional drivers had a natural interaction with the real drivers.
Yeah.
And given how many race weekends they were at, given that they had Drive to Survive camera crews around that they could have used to do some of this, they really missed an opportunity, I think, to you know, get a couple of shots of Brad Pitt just chatting to Sergio Perez and just get a 10-second shot of them talking nonsense before somebody comes up and goes, "Hey, Sonny, you need it in the briefing." You
know, fair enough.
In the pits.
Yeah.
You know, they could have done that and it would have rooted the film much better in the contemporary sport in a way that they didn't quite manage to do for me with the very stagey wooden appearances of the real people in the sport. And that's a great shame.
On the other hand, the integration of the two fictional Apex cars into the racing material was flawless. I cannot understand how they did that as well as they did. And that was the best bit for me. I loved it. It's a good comedy. Brad Pitt does good comedy. You know, in Inglourious Basterds, he's got one of the funniest lines in all of filmdom. Buongiorno. If you know the moment, you know what I'm talking about. And he does do some nice comedic moments in the film. And I enjoyed that much more than the serious stuff. But yeah, if you haven't seen F1, yeah, if you're an F1 fan, go and watch it. You'll enjoy, I wouldn't say pulling it apart, but you'll enjoy noticing the subtleties. It's very satisfying.
You will be entertained.
Yeah, you will. Are we not entertained? And our entertainment will return in a moment with Alex Goy.
You know you're a car nut when
you're doing up your house, so you go out to buy some weather-resistant paint at a local paint store. So you're looking at the range of shades available, and the brand name catches your eye. A blue diamond-shaped logo with the letters PPG written in white. And you think, wait a minute, I know that logo. PPG. Long-time sponsors of not just IndyCar teams, but were indeed the title sponsor of the series for a very long time. I had no idea what PPG did. It didn't register with me at all. So you could argue that their advertising didn't work. However, subliminally, when I came to choose the brand of paint I wanted for my house, that instant recognition and indeed association with a sport I love, motorsport, meant boom, they got their sale. Who says advertising doesn't work? Mind you, I hope the paint lasts as long as Tony Kanaan's IndyCar career.
You know you're a car nut when you choose paint based on race car sponsors.
You're a chosen speed!
For the first time in, I don't know, 7 weeks, I am talking live to Alex Goy. Hello, Alex.
Hi, friends. How are we doing?
Well, I'm good. I can't speak for Zog. Zog seems stable, I think.
Moderately stable.
How you been? You enjoyed the summer? Because we missed you at 20 Years on Speed. We're so sorry you couldn't be there. But thank you for your glorious, luxurious 4K drone shot film, which only the people who attended the gig will have seen. Thank you very much for that.
It was very
good. Very, very welcome. Well, sadly, because I couldn't be there with you, I figured I would give you a message in a way I only could.
Whilst driving a fast car.
Whilst driving an Audi RS6 GT, which is a wonderful, wonderful thing. So of late, I've been creating, hosting, producing films for Driven. The website's driven.site. The YouTube channel is Driven on YouTube. So been doing that for a few months. That's been a good giggle, which has basically involved lots of cocking about, which I thoroughly enjoyed. My plan was to send you a message via Bentley Continental GT, but I forgot because it was a.
You're having too much fun.
I had two cars in the time between not being able to make it and it going live, or it being broadcast, and I was like, right, I've got to do it on one of these. I've got to do it right. I'll do it with the Bentley, and then the Bentley came and went. Thankfully, shout out to my wonderful friend and longtime collaborator, Matt Murray, who was shooting on the day. I went, mate, would you mind awfully? I just need to do a quick message. And if you can just cut it together with a drive-by just to lead into, that would be wonderful. And I said, look, send me an invoice separately. And he went, oh, don't worry about it, mate. I'll do it for you. And he sent me a thing saying, oh, is this okay? Is this fine? I was like, mate, that's beyond expectations. So, yes, many funds were had.
It looked like a Hollywood movie or a Grand Tour film. It truly, truly
that's
did.
That's what you can expect at youtube.com/driven on YouTube.
Working as a team. Yay. That Bentley GT that you were driving, Alex, it wasn't the Bentley, which is the car most named after this podcast ever, which I think is the GT Speed. Can you think about it? GT Gaz Top and Speed. It's almost the Bentley Gareth Jones on Speed, but not quite. It wasn't almost the GT Speed, it was the GT, right?
Well, it was the GT Mulliner, which has the same powertrain as the speed. So 4-litre V8, twin turbocharged V8, hooked up to a hybrid system. So it's got 771 brake horsepower.
It's not enough.
Which is... it's quite a lot. Quite a lot. 0-60, 3.2, top speed 200-ish. You know, silly, silly thing. And yeah, so Mulliner, if you don't know sort of how Bentley works, so you get the GT, which they've sort of just released the base one of, which has less power, but still ballistically quick. Then you get the Speed, which is the mega quick one. But then Mulliner is, it used to be, if you can cast your minds back to when cars used to be made you'd have a manufacturer and then a coach builder. Mulliner was a coach builder, and now it's sort of Bentley's in-house luxury arm.
Mulliner so Park Mulliner's, Ward, they were called, weren't they?
Yes. And Mulliner now, it does the special commissions, so you can go in and say, well, I don't like the stuff on standard, so what can you do for me? And they'll do sort of different colour this and different trim this, and the kind of the what you can do with it is greater, sort of sky's the limit. It also does the heritage Bentley blowers and...
Right. There's a lot of that
the
now.
The Butter and the Bacalars and things like that. So it does all of that stuff as well. So it's very, very specialised in what it does. The one I had was a sort of gorgeous sort of grey-blue, and it had this awesome heritage leather. So it looked like the inside of a cricket ball, which is pretty mega.
Wow. The inside of a cricket
ball. Thoroughly enjoyed that. Yeah, it was. Luckily, we've had such a wonderful summer for shooting cars. I had a great time in it. I thought it was absolutely wonderful, sort of bimbling round.
Just a small aside while we're on sort of the heritage or continuation theme. Did you see yesterday that Land Rover are going to build 10 Churchill edition Defenders? Have you seen this, you guys?
My feed this morning.
300 grand each, I believe. I think.
Yeah, great.
I'll have four.
230, so 400 horsepower V8, so it's that supercharged 5-litre V8 that we all know and love.
No, I think it's the normally aspirated AJ V8. What do they call it? The AJ V8, isn't it? I think.
Let me have a look.
Yeah, go on.
Let me have a look. 0-60 in as little as 5.9 seconds for the 90 and 6.1 for the 110.
Wow.
Which is fast enough. Frankly,
I'm looking at the engine for you.
I'm just looking at
adequately fast for that vehicle, I would say.
Yeah, a bit silly, frankly.
Crikey.
Bit silly. I mean, I like the fact they still make these things, but I can see why people would start raising eyebrows.
The price tag
AJ
is extraordinary.
There you are. You're right.
Yeah, the AJ. Yeah, cool. But you've been driving.
Lots.
Other vehicles, part of the VW group and not part of the Geely group, I understand as well. What do you want to do first? The VW group car or the Geely group car?
Whichever takes your fancy, really. I think the Geely group car I've got more to say about.
Well, let's talk about her then, because we're talking about the Lotus...
The Lotus Emira Turbo SE.
Turbo SE. They keep upping the spec, don't they? So
they do. Basically, Lotus has given the Emira lineup a little bit of a tickle, shall we say.
Is that because it's not selling in America?
Well, you can still buy them in America. You can still buy Emiras in America. They're still trying to sell them, but I'm not sure how successful they are because they're still dealing with tariffs and things like that. And I don't know the ins and outs of that. I know there's sort of going to be a limited number of cars that'll get away with minimal tariffs, and then after that, it gets more expensive. Like for the mega pricey stuff, it doesn't matter quite so much, but for stuff like Emiras and Vantages and Evoques and stuff like that, you know, 25% or whatever makes a huge difference. A huge, huge difference.
Heck yeah.
So the Emira lineup's been given a zhuzh. So it used to be you'd have the turbo and then you'd have the V6. And the turbo came with 360 horsepower and the V6 came with 400. One was a 2-litre inline four turbocharged thing with an 8-speed DCT out of a Merc AMG.
Yeah.
And the other was the tried and tested 3.5-litre 6-speed manual V6 that we're familiar with from the Evora.
Yeah, the Toyota block, ultimately, isn't
it? Toyota block. We're familiar with that. But what's happened now is sort of what we figured was going to happen eventually anyway. Lotus has turned the wick up on the turbo. So now the lineup is Turbo, Turbo SE and V6 SE. So V6 SE and Turbo SE get all the toys. There are obviously options, but it's all the toys. So you can have the track chassis and you can have track mode, and they both have 400 horsepower. But the interesting thing is the Turbo SE, despite being in the middle of the range by a good few thousand pounds, if memory serves, it's a £7,000 difference between the Turbo SE and the V6 SE, or thereabouts. The Turbo SE is a hair lighter.
Is this the sweet spot in the range then, do you think?
Well, this is the thing that's confusing. So the base turbo is £79,500. So that one's basically the car that we know.
Mm.
But that comes with the touring chassis, and I think you can spec in other stuff to it. But that gets 360-odd horsepower and sort of 4 and a bit second 0-62 time.
Mm.
And then 89,500 is the Turbo SE. That's 4 seconds dead to 62 and 400 horsepower and £354 in feet. But then the V6, which is the one that you want if you're a purist, so that's got the manual box and it's got the V6 and all the noise and all the drama, that's slower to 62, same 400 horsepower, a bit less torque, but you do get the V6 and the manual. So the way I figured it is that the Turbo SE is either the best deal in the world or the worst, and I can't quite square the circle, because if you buy the Turbo, you get into an Emira, you still have 360 horsepower. It's not that much slower than the V6.
Yeah.
You get the Lotus look, you get the Lotus steering, the Lotus feel, you know, all of that's the same. 360 horsepower is quick enough, frankly, yeah. Sub 5 to 62, definitely quick enough.
It's probably nimbler, isn't it? Lighter significantly than
the
V6.
It's a smidge lighter,
a smidge.
If memory serves, than Turbo SE. But the Turbo SE gets a few more toys, but also more power and more torque. But then the V6, if you want that engagement and if you want the kind of the Lotus feel that so many people crave, that's a lot more expensive, but you do get the extra bits of engagement and you get the noise. I love that V6 noise. It's just amazing. And it still looks the absolute bomb as well. So either you've got a £7,000 saving over the V6, or you're spending about £10,000 more for a car that you can get 99% of the grunt in,
right? Yeah,
already.
Yeah.
So that's the confusing bit. The good thing is, it is really fast.
I bet it
is. It's really, really quick. Yeah. It's like a rocket ship. And I always forget.
That makes up for a lot of.
It does make up for a lot of it. The turbo motor makes an absolutely glorious noise. It sort of pops and whisses and bangs, which is brilliant when you're giving it some stick. But when you're on the motorway, it's a bit droney and you just want to like add a couple of miles an hour to overtake someone going slowly in a Honda Jazz. You do struggle a little bit with sort of the constant psh, 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 and it
very good impression, by the way. I think that's worthy of a round of applause.
It can get a little tiring. But the car itself, I mean, I found the track chassis, maybe because I'm a bit old, I find it a bit
too much,
a bit too lumpy bumpy.
Mm.
Like if that was, I view these things as if it was your only car, which is probably the wrong way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're sort of long gone of when you could just buy a Lotus and that could be your only car. So it would probably be a second or maybe even third car. So it could just be the thing for fun, but as something just to razz around in, I'd probably go for the softer chassis and the slightly less grippy tyres, because you get grippier tyres if you go for the track spec everything.
I have a question. A Lotus in trouble because of the whole tariff thing. They were talking about the possibility of ending manufacturing at Hethel, and what's his name? Matt Windle has gone as the MD, isn't he?
Matt is a truly wonderful human being.
He is, yes.
I adore that man. So yeah, the rumour went round that they were going to ditch production at Hethel, and then that was quickly quashed. So that is still going to happen. It's still going ahead. But Matt has since gone. He has been replaced by someone whose name completely escapes me at the moment. What Lotus is going to do, I don't know. Obviously, the Emira's sort of life cycle, when it first came out, it was mooted. It was going to be a £60,000-ish sports car in it, and then in its lightest form would be 1,405 kilos, which upset a lot of people because that's too heavy for a Lotus, but it has airbags and crash protection and CarPlay and carpets and aircon that actually works. And the V6 came out and it was quite a bit more expensive, and then there were delays. because of course that was, we're sort of still pandemic-y around then.
There were supply delays, weren't there?
There were supply delays and semiconductors and this and that and this and that. And then parts and raw materials went up. That went across the board. You would have noticed that everything, every car got a bit more expensive. So it had a very troubled birth. And so now it's had this sort of spec glow up, which is wonderful, but the car itself hasn't really fundamentally changed. So another problem, it's a similar problem that Morgan has. The biggest competitor to a new Emira is a used Emira. Because there are plenty of those kicking about now, because there was a big sort of rush for them and then people have come to sell them. So there are quite a few out there that aren't big money. But now you can get one in green or you can get one in purple, which is a huge win for me. The one they sent me was black, which was a nightmare to photograph at night, but ho-hum. The thing that gets me about it, though, because I haven't owned a Lotus now for lots and lots and lots of years. I think nearly 9 years, something like that, 7 or 8 years. And I forget how good the steering is.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I only have them for like a few days at a time or a week or two. In the case of the Emira, I had it for 2 weeks. I was very lucky. And the steering is just incredible. It's not too heavy. It's also not too light, but it's beautifully direct. And because the car's mid-engine and set up for NAF British roads, basically, it's perfectly weighted for whatever you want to do with it. Strangely, I had an accidental twin test the week after because I had a Cayman GTS in for a few days, which, and they're essentially competing,
one's got
a 4.6 liter, the other's got a 2.4 liter, but you know, similar power, similar ethos, kind of. And the Porsche felt a lot heavier, a lot more purposeful. It was still absolutely glorious. The steering was mega, but jumping back into the Lotus almost immediately after the Cayman was a bit of an eye-opener on how two cars can go about the same thing in such different ways. They both felt incredible, but as something to cruise around in, the Emira was a lot less, I wouldn't say work, but it was a lot less involved on the day-to-day. But when you want to give them both a shoeing, they're both excellent fun. And the way the Emira gathers its speed, because it is so light and the way they've set it up, that it hides a bit of its chunk, you can just get up and go. And you've got all that turbo torque that just whooshes you up the numbers remarkably quickly. And it's a truly wonderful bit of kit. The only thing I found that made me cross with it is it's got this 8-speed DCT. And I drove one when the turbo first came out a couple of years ago, and it was a bit slow to go from drive to reverse, and the paddles took a little bit of time. But this time, when I was trying to do 3-point turns, getting it from go to drive to reverse and back and forward was an incredibly slow process, to the point where I'm like, well, I'm doing an interesting 3-point turn in an interesting bit of the countryside, and I'd quite like to get going now. Oh, no. Oh, and it decided it's a gearbox. Hooray! Off we go. That was frustrating. And if you don't have your foot on the brake enough and you think it's engaged the gear, but it actually hasn't, you end up at an angle in a road just revving your fancy sports car, looking like a bit of a numpty.
A car that requires a certain amount of adaption, by the sound of things. You can't quite drive it with that pedal DSG in the way you might want to.
To be honest, I think it's something Lotus can and probably will work out. Maybe I got one that hadn't had that bit of software update or whatever.
Let's hope so.
But yeah, that took a little bit of time. But the one thing that got me there was, it was just the price. It's a £90,000 car before you put toys on it, before you start selecting colours and things like that.
Lotus have always struggled with, haven't they? Mm. You know, trying to keep the price down. Zogger is a man who absolutely adores both Porsche and Lotus, which I know you are. God, which would you have, that Emira Turbo SE, or would you have a Cayman?
I'm inclined towards the Cayman, and that would have been my take actually before hearing Alex's take on it. But that's kind of sort of reinforcing what I'd expect, I think, really.
To be honest, to a large degree, I agree with you, because the PDK box is just better. The way it composes itself, plus you get that flat six noise, which is just incredible. The look of the thing, I really like. I think what I concluded in various road tests and films is that you buy the Lotus because you want the Lotus. You buy the Porsche because you want the Porsche. And if you're in the middle, you'll do some proper head maths and you'll go, okay, what can I buy it for? Then what can I sell it for? And it's not stuff like MPG, because the Lotus was managing like 35-40 mpg at some point, which is mad for a sports car. I mean, in fairness, that Bentley Conti GT was doing mid-30s on run
until
I started playing around like a numpty, which is mad for a 700-odd horse or nearly 800-horsepower car.
That weighs 2.5 tonnes. Yeah.
Yes. But yeah, the Lotus, it's a heart-over-head car.
Sure. Although neither of those two cars is something that you buy entirely with your head. You know they're both heart-led purchases, undoubtedly.
There's
no wrong answer, really.
No.
I've got a question. Alex, are Aston Martin sales okay at the moment? Are they still struggling in a little bit of decline? The reason I ask this is that there has been some background chatter in the Ethernet of the possibility of Geely coming into Formula One as a 12th team and branding it Lotus, of course, because they own Lotus. Now, I'm guessing that Aston Martin's presence in Formula One is doing it all sorts of good, particularly in America, in Arab states, and where people buy Aston Martins, where they've got loads of cash. And really, Lotus could probably benefit from that as well, because the thing that stops Lotus from being the world's greatest car company is it doesn't sell enough cars, right? If it sold cars on the volume that Porsche did, Lotus would be incredible. And so you need a marketing push, really. They've got the engineering, the technology, and the marketing push should be a Lotus Formula One team again.
I mean, well, on the Aston thing, so I was very lucky when I went to Le Mans, I interviewed Adrian Hallmark, their new CEO.
What a great name that is, by the way.
The full interview is on motor1.com. but he was essentially saying that his mission is to turn Aston around the same way he turned Bentley around in half the time he did it.
And not turn it around in the way that you might turn around a Lotus with paddle gearboxes, very slowly, nimbly.
Bentley went from sort of the car your sweaty uncle drove to the car that cool people drove, right?
Yeah.
And he wants to do that with Aston Martin. And one of the interesting points he made is, you know, the turnaround on cars in that segment is a couple of years. You buy your ultimate luxury SUV or, you know, GT, and then a couple of years on, you shift it. Because, you know, while they're very special cars to the likes of you and I, if you can afford one, you can probably afford 10. So you just skip from one to the other. But the point he made was that there's nowhere in the Aston range for someone to go.
Uh-huh.
Once you've finished with your DBX 707, where'd you go after that? You get a new one in a different colour. Well, what's the point?
Mm-hmm.
So what you're going to start seeing very, very soon, in fact, are S variants. There's DBX S is launching in 2 weeks' time. I'm going to drive it. It's going to be wonderful. So you get in your 707 and then you go, right, well, here's the next product. Every other manufacturer, he said, has this excuse for people to change their cars. You know, if you look at Gallardo or Huracan, there was a new version every couple of years where the base one was still there, but then you could jump into your Superleggera, your Balboni, your LP570, LP580, LP600, 2, 4, whatever. And there was always an excuse for somewhere to go. And that's something that Aston hasn't had really to this point. And that's coming. So that might be an answer to your question. I mean, I haven't seen Aston sales figures recently. I know Valhalla is coming. There will be a Vantage S, obviously, and a Vanquish S and all these sort of extra things. But I think there's going to be a lot of stuff stopping and a lot of ways of doing things changing quite dramatically to cut costs and up profits in the Aston camp.
Well, let's hope they survive. I love an Aston Martin. I love the fact that they build cars in Wales. The only people who are doing that, I believe, at the moment. And we wish Lotus well as well. I'm concerned about Lotus. You know, you hear these reports and you think, oh gosh, I hope that doesn't happen. But hey, long as they're turning out decent cars, there's hope.
Yes. Yes, there is.
And indeed, as they say in a little town near Wrexham, there's an expression there, you live in hope, but die in Caergwrle, because there's a village known as Hope next to a village known as Caergwrle near Wrexham. There you go, that's your North Wales factoid for today. You've been listening to Gareth Jones on Speed. He was Alex.
Bye.
He was Zug.
Goodbye.
And it's lovely to catch up with you boys, and lovely to have you with us. Stick around for, there could be more celebratory stuff for 20 years on Speed. We've got a bunch of songs to publish coming up in the show soon. But for now, say bye, everyone.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
you enjoyed this show, then please like, share and subscribe. For information on how to contact the show, see pictures, read song lyrics, follow us on social media, or to sponsor this podcast, go to garethjones.tv. Gareth Jones on Speed is made in Wales by Wizz.